The Guardian.
Anybody for Nick Sherratt? Straight down to the Guardian stage.
Hot's
the vegetable curry.
I can't
taste
it.
It's too kind.
Yeah,
but
no,
my hot may not be yours.
Okay.
Do have a strawberry, my dear.
My life would be made complete if you would take one of my strawberries.
Anybody for Nick Sherratt?
And local guidebooks.
Vent 206.
Straight down to the Guardian stage.
Yeah, right. Stuck in the mud.
Can we check it? The tickets for Double Trouble?
Yeah, Roger McGough.
The sounds of the Hay Festival mingle with the ethereal kora music of Sekou Keita, who played last night at the Barclays Wealth Pavilion and dropped into the Guardian's House of Hay to record a session specially for us. More of that later. Welcome to a jam-packed Haycast. I'm Claire Armistead, and today we'll escape the festival site and go cycling with Jeremy Whittle, author of a new book on the dark side of the Tour de France. And
you see evergreens, you see hedges, you see blossoming rhododendrons.
I'll be taking some time out at one of Herefordshire's most beautiful gardens. Joining me in the House of Hay today is John Reader, who probably knows more about the potato than anyone else in Wales. He's just written a book called Propitious Exculent. And also here is the writer and broadcaster Colin Tudge, who is in Hay to talk about how trees hold the key to the evolutionary past and future. Is that a correct summation of it?
It's not bad, yes.
But before we get going, a quick question to both of you. How do you like your potatoes?
I like them too much, and I like them always, actually. I hate douchettes. I think that's just stupid. But
wouldn't do it to a potato.
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't.
Well, what first came to mind was a creamy mash, actually. And I thought, well, then you've got to put it on top of a cottage pie or something like that, and then put a crust on it, a bit of sprinkling of cheese, maybe.
Talking of cheese, one of the cheesier things that's going on at the festival is the launch of something called Summer Hugs, which encourages people to go and find an ancient tree to hug. Did you know about this?
I think I did, yes.
Apparently the oak is a good notion. One for hugging with friends, whereas the rowan, you have to be on your own, really.
Is that right?
Do trees like being hugged?
Well, they're a bit small, aren't they, rowans, for group hugging. Some people say they do. I mean, I know some very serious botanists who say if you wrap your arms around, you can feel the sap rising up through them. You can see the life, you can feel the life of them. So some people swear, but I don't do it myself.
We won't be going out there at the moment.
I'm not going to mock it, no. And it's good to take them seriously, that's the point, take them seriously.
Yes. In my park, they're always getting at us for jogging under the trees. They say the tree roots are all getting stressed by the urban
Wouldn't
joggers.
Wouldn't be surprised, yeah. It's very important, that, actually. Yeah,
but the trees are not going to have much hugging at the moment, are they? Because the weather's so bad.
No, that doesn't do them any good either, being flooded. But some trees quite like it.
So let's just have Hadley Freeman, the Guardian's deputy fashion editor, with today's weather bulletin and her tips on what to wear.
Today will start cloudy and dry. As the day goes on, it'll become increasingly unsettled with possible thunderstorms in the Hay on Wye region.
It's slightly cooler today. Well, I think there's one excuse to do the quilted body warmer in homage of the Chanel look for next season. With that, I think perhaps a small denim miniskirt, maybe from Topshop just for a change, and obviously the Wellington boots. Perfect for a kind of French ingenue look.
John Reader, your book charts the history of the potato. Do they like rain, or would they prefer it a little drier?
I think they'd prefer it a lot drier than this. I mean, the danger is now that if the temperature's high and so on, then blight is... It becomes a high probability. My own potatoes back in the allotment, beginning of the week, I was quite pleased we were getting so much rain, but this is enough now.
And it also has great nutritional value, doesn't it?
That's why the Irish population was growing as much as it was. I mean, it's the best bundle of nutrition known.
Better than grain?
Yes. If you have to eat anything on its own, if you eat enough potatoes to provide your energy needs, the ratio of carbohydrate to protein is such that you get an adequate supply of protein. Oh, yeah. And it's high-quality protein, too, with those essential amino acids and so on. Mm-hmm. And it's got trace elements in it and so.
And vitamin C.
And vitamin C, indeed. And then furthermore, it's four times more productive than grain in terms of land area and labour input.
I mean, the price of rice has doubled since January, hasn't it? Is this the key to feeding the world's population, do you think?
It is and it isn't. I mean, it's very good at feeding people at subsistence level. But actually, lifting them up out of poverty, it doesn't do so well.
Mm.
What has happened recently, though, over the last 20, 30 years, I mean, China has become a very good example of the way in which it can be made to work. I mean, I'm not a great fan of centralized organizations, wherever they are, but you've got to admit that the Chinese decided 20 or so years ago that they could see that their population is rising at a rate that their grain production is not going to be able to meet, nor indeed the world's grain production. So they decided that we're going to use the potato.
Colin, you wrote a book called Feeding People is Easy.
Mm.
And I know there's a meeting of world leaders in Rome next week to discuss the food crisis.
Mm.
What recommendations would you make?
Oh, the main recommendation of my book is that you have to design agriculture worldwide to feed people. Very, very simple, one sentence. And if you did that, it wouldn't be that difficult to provide 6.5 billion people with good food, and indeed the 9 billion that we expect by 2050. That could be done fairly comfortably, actually. I mean, my title of my book's a bit of an exaggeration, Feeding People is Easy, but it's not that hard. And the reason at the moment that we're failing so miserably, firstly, the rich governments and all that lot, well, they don't give a damn, actually. Secondly, but the main thing is that the whole thing is geared to this ludicrous market economy, which is supposed to solve all our problems. There's competition between grain grown for food and grain grown for biofuels, which is, of course, the great saviour of the world. Basically, we've got three choices now. In recent years, we've had two choices. You could either grow grain to feed people, and indeed potatoes, but grains are bigger, you know, in terms of their importance. You either grow grains to feed people, or you could feed them to cattle or other forms of livestock, and thus bump the price up, you know, the effective price. So the reality is that at the moment we feed half the world's wheat, and wheat is the biggest crop, to cattle or other livestock. The rice more or less gets away with it. The rice is not really fed to livestock. Maize, which is the third biggest of the great cereals, therefore the third biggest of the world's crops, 80% of it goes to livestock. And with barley, everything that isn't made into beer and whiskey, you could say virtually everything that's left is for feed. And that's one of the main reasons why we're not feeding people. We're just completely misusing the whole grain crop.
Well, there are lots of people concerned about sustainable food production at Hay. The Wiggly Wigglers are encouraging festival goers to compost. There are organised farm visits showing people where their food is from. And then there are the many, many climate change events. But one person who's taken a long view of the plant world is Andrea Wolfe, who has written a botanical history called The Brother Gardeners. Andrea and I donned our wellies and ventured out to Brobery House, which is surrounded by 8 acres of beautifully landscaped gardens. Andrea, tell us a bit about the place that we're standing right now in this beautiful garden.
It's a garden where you see lots of different trees, very light foliage, dark foliage. You see evergreens, you see hedges, you see blossoming rhododendrons. So it's a very colourful garden, in shades of green but also in colour.
So now let's get on to the Brother Gardeners themselves, who are a fabulous collection of characters.
Well, they were, I think, an extraordinary group of men who are all absolutely obsessed with botany and with plant collecting and with gardens. And there's one, which is Peter Collinson, who was a London cloth merchant, who always tried to use his business contacts in the North American colonies to send him plants. He was introduced to an American farmer called John Bartram, who literally crisscrossed the whole of the North American colonies and sent back seed boxes, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, which then Collinson distributed to his gardening friends. And in a way, they kind of transported America to England and utterly changed the English landscape.
How would this have looked before the brother gardeners arrived?
Well, a very typical late 17th century garden and early 18th century garden would have looked very, very formal. It would have been a garden where each plant, each specimen would have been like almost like a gem in a jewel box, very much kind of on its own, and actually pretty dreary, because in Britain you only have four native evergreens. So the brother gardener actually introduced many pine trees, many conifers, and they introduced a lot of trees which brought autumn foliage to the country.
Tell me a bit about Joseph Banks. Now, he was the sort of superstar, the rock star of plant collecting in the 18th century, wasn't he?
He's very adventurous. The first thing he does is he joins the most daring voyage of all times when he joins Captain Cook on the Endeavour, and he kind of circumnavigates the globe. So he sees plants no white man has ever seen, for example, in Australia. Unlike Collinson, who collects for beauty, he believes that botany really brings an economic profit to the country. So he sets out to turn Kew Gardens into a storehouse of the empire and really into an engine of colonial growth. So he thinks, you know, if we can transplant the breadfruit tree from the East Indies to the West Indies, that would be good food for the slave population there. So he's seeing botany really as a way to expand the power of England.
John, Andrea talks there about one particular turning point in the evolution of the British landscape. With the huge pressure on land for development and all those debates about greenfield versus brownfield sites, are we at another more drastic turning point, do you think?
I think it's already started, actually, and we haven't begun to realise the implications of it, and that's urbanisation. Not simply in the Western world, but in the Third World, when there's 50% of the world's population living in cities, and really no way back, as far as I can see, that people aren't going to take whole communities, go back and live off the land again at a subsistence level. I think Colin put it very well just now, that the market economy is what's causing the problems. But I'd say there's got to be a middle ground somewhere. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of what I was saying earlier about the potato. The difficulty is that it feeds people, but it doesn't actually improve standards of living. And the only way, I would say, the evidence, historical evidence, the only way to keep population growth under control is to increase standards of living.
What about if we turn it back to trees? Will there be trees in 100 years?
Oh, God, if there isn't trees in 100 years, there won't be us. I mean, we're utterly dependent on trees, did we but know it. Even the governments of the world have now realised that you can't go knocking over tropical forests forever, for example, because I think the statistic is something like 20% of all the increase in carbon in the atmosphere, which is causing the global warming, is due to deforestation, i.e. mostly meaning knocking over tropical forest. And that didn't even feature in Kyoto, for example, because they were interested in planting new forest. It did occur to people that knew anything that you ought to be protecting old forests, but the legislators couldn't think of a way of organising that. So it was neglected. So the deforestation continued. And so long as the deforestation continues, everything else that you do is a waste of time.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you're listening to the Guardian Haycast.
Well, yesterday, busloads of kids descended on hay to see favourite authors like Louise Renison and Georgia Bing. And the illustrator Nick Sharrock had them queuing round the block. One supposedly adult event was Jeremy Clarkson. Safraz Mansour went along.
You have famously and fairly aggressively been against environmental development of non-fossil fuel cars.
Because I said that the Third World wouldn't have anything to eat.
What?
Well, I always said that if you start turning all crops into fuel...
No, but there are other things. What about electric cars? I drove...
Oh, no, electric cars.
Why aren't you using your influence to get the motor companies to...
Make electric cars?
Yeah.
Hydrogen is, I believe, is where it'll end up.
And are you using your influence to...
I don't have any influence.
Oh, bullshit.
No, really, because... really, statistically backed up. Because when I said that the Ford Orion was the worst car ever in the world, it went on to be Britain's best-selling car. And when I reviewed the Renault A610, I remember that, this is brilliant, they must all have one, they sold six. Makes no difference what I say. Top Gear's just fluff.
Did you like it? What did you think?
I thought he was great, actually. He's very entertaining, but he's like that on telly in any case, because he's got enough to say.
I thought he was tanked up.
He's very honest and very to the point, and he's not one to bullshit, is he, really?
What's his appeal?
We can kind of relate to him, and I think he comes across very well to all age groups.
You almost feel like he's your friend.
I want to ask you something. Have you been to anything else apart from
this? No, I haven't.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
So out of the whole Hay Festival, this is the only event you've gone to?
Yeah. He's probably the most interesting guy out of the lot of them.
Yeah, we're not really into books and poetry and literature, so he's very opposite, isn't he?
Pretty disarming about the idea of him having any influence as well.
Didn't disarm me because he's able to say, I recommended this, no one bought it, I said that was shit and everyone bought it. But that's not the influence, personally, that interests me, so... You know, he's part of a consensus, and it's wrong to hold him up as being solely responsible, tempting though it is.
Another event yesterday was Bad Blood, given by journalist Jeremy Whittle, who talked about his experiences covering the Tour de France. The Guardian's own bike doctor, Matt Seaton, went along for a ride with him afterwards.
Well, here we are in lovely Hay countryside, and I'm here with Jeremy Whittle, who has a book out called Bad Blood, The Secret Life of the Tour de France. What appealed to you about the Tour de France in particular?
I think it was just the exoticism of it, and it was also these supermen racing over these massive mountains that I couldn't understand how they could do it day after day.
I mean, you ended up following the Tour de France as a reporter, and so you got very close to it, sort of sitting next to Lance Armstrong while he was having his breakfast. But the story of your book is one of disillusion.
As you say, I was an obsessive fan. I felt at first I was really privileged to be there, and then I slowly realised, just through conversations with the people, through all the gossip, through the kind of just what I saw, that increasingly there was something going on, there was a subtext. Mm-hmm. And when I realised that subtext was drugs and was doping, I had to choose who I really believed in, who I had faith in, and who I didn't have faith in. And, you know, for someone who'd been in love with the sport and then become a journalist, that was very difficult.
The story of the Tour in recent years has been one of sort of disgrace and disappointment. Tell me a little bit more about blood doping, because unfortunately the drugs really do work, and there's a particular drug, isn't there, called EPO?
Well, one or two of the riders I interviewed in the book, they told me that they'd taken EPO, and they also revealed that they felt it given them a 20% improvement in performance, which is, if you extrapolate that to the Olympic marathon or the 10,000 metres, it's a phenomenal improvement, and that's going to make a difference to the result and to your earning power as well.
When we're talking about all kinds of doping in cycling, but particularly blood doping, what are we actually talking about? What do people really do?
One of the techniques is to remove blood that's red blood cell rich, which is to say it's more oxygenated.
More efficient.
And then obviously when you get to a situation where you've been through 2 weeks of hell and you're struggling and fatigued, if you pump in the blood that you brought back from wherever, that's going to make a big difference, because that's going to improve your efficiency, your aerobic capacity, and generally make the race a lot less painful.
And it's a brutally tough sport as well, isn't it?
I remember I did an interview with David Miller once where he said to me, everybody gets very anxious about us using any performance enhancing products, but they don't have any qualms about us riding down the Pyrenees and freezing fog at 60 miles an hour. And he's got a point, you know, there's a kind of a gladiatorial brutality to cycling that you don't see in other sports, where, you know, they're supposed to ride off a precipice, then hop back on their bikes and continue on to the finish for the romance and tradition. Whereas in football, of course, you know, you get touched and you have to be stretchered off.
One of the things I think you write about very well is that there's this conspiracy of silence in the sport, and that in a way is a conspiracy of all the actors in cycling. But I mean, what's the mechanism that leads to this huge problem?
One of the key drivers has been the financial wealth that's come to the sport in the last 10 years. The incentives for people to dope are far greater than the incentives for them not to dope.
In a way, I think what we love cycling for are the kind of heroic stories, and if you can't believe in the heroes who are supposed to be being heroic, then it all falls apart.
But that, well, that's what's so sad for me, because the pit of cycling for me was the romance of it. When I realised that actually that wasn't the driving force, that wasn't the motor of the sport, the motor of sport was money, and that behind that was, you know, corporate funded cheating, I was appalled.
It's an absolutely fascinating topic, and as a cycling fan myself and a participant in the sport, you know, I feel you really sort of nailed it for us and speak for all of us. I think we are now going to paddle off into the Hay on Wye sunset.
Matt Seaton there talking to Jeremy Whittle. So isn't it depressing that even something as apparently innocent as cycling has been corrupted by corporately funded cheating? It's not only, of course, cyclists who are pumped up, it's also food.
It is to me amazing that I mean, there was a guy at the beginning of the 19th century who pointed out in about the 1830s that food then was seriously adulterated. I mean, people were adding things like mercury to make tea green, and there was a fashion for green tea, and they were adding lead to make it black because there was a fashion for black tea, and that kind of thing, and people were dying in droves. What we now have with the so-called food industry, the food process industry, is legalized adulteration, which is unbelievable. I mean, adulteration is bad, but at least if you recognize it's crooked, then you do something about it.
Are you not being a bit anti-science here? Because isn't part of it about science?
I'm very pro-science, but science has to be used for the right reasons. And science should be, I mean, that science is what I did, you know, it's what I do at university, all that stuff. But science should be on the side of humanity, and it should be on the side of enlightenment. Otherwise, it's nothing. At the moment, it's on the side of big business. Is on the side of fat cats, and in fact, not beating about the bush, on the side of corruption. As you probably know, I'm sure you do know, chicken is injected with pig proteins in order to hold more, so that it can hold more water.
It's obscene,
by osmosis.
Isn't it? Yeah.
It's obscene. Not only is it cheating, but I mean, for people like Muslims who go to huge lengths to avoid pork, it's a serious provocation.
Well, that's all for today's programme. If you want to find out more about the food crisis, visit the Guardian website, where this week there are videos, food diaries and interactive reports on the subject from all around the globe. Many thanks to my guests, John Reader and Colin Tudge. Tomorrow, Safraz Mansour will be here with Friends of the Earth, Tony Juniper, Raymond Tallis, who's searching for the site of our consciousness, and Robert Mile, who's written about the importance of the sun to our spirits. But for now, I'll leave you with more music from Sekou Keita.
I'm from Senegal, West Africa. And I play this instrument called the kora. It's an African harp made out of a goat, pumpkin. And the members of the band got Sura Suso on calabas and Binta Suso on vocal. I'm going to play this song from the new album, Sinimbo Passage, called Fondinke, which is more talking about the youth, young people.
Ni be kile sa ponye, kana ni ne saliva to la. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.